Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who's been in other phases of that war, other facets of it certainly, in uniform, in fact, the uniform of the United States Rangers of the Army. He is a man who is now serving on the House Armed Services Committee in the House of Representatives and representing the people of the 5th District of Oklahoma is Congressman Steve Russell. He distinguished himself in uniform. He's distinguishing himself now in the congressional environment, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Congressman, welcome back. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you.
I'm anxious to talk about many things, particularly related to the sort of theater in which you've spent a lot of time. But before I do, the theater you're in at the moment is pretty high drama, too. Any thoughts at the moment and where we are with respect to the Republican leadership in the House, a decision that will be made, I guess, formally on Thursday of next week?
Well, it will. We've got a big day on that day. I know there'll be lots of discussion. I think really the backdrop, a lot of it is, you know, who has offered themselves as candidates? What are our choices? And what are the things that we have remaining to do by the end of the year? And all of those things are factors. And, you know, I understand the anger of everybody. I mean, no one understands it more than those of us in Congress who receive it on a daily basis. But, you know, this notion that somehow we're not listening or we don't care or all of that is just absurd. And the American people are really not informed on the inner workings of Congress and how it works. And I would dare say that McCarthy, if you had asked people, who is Kevin McCarthy, 2 weeks ago, 99% of them of America probably couldn't even have told you who he was. And now suddenly they all have these opinions about it. And so it's really rather fascinating to watch the dynamic.
They're being informed for good or ill by some of the things that he's been saying and doing lately, but there'll be more opinions yet between now and Thursday, I'm sure.
Well, and we'll see some of that play out. And I am only aware of two people that have put their name forward, which would be McCarthy, and Webster is also one of the candidates that I'm. And among those, I've not heard any other. I certainly have been called and contacted by all kinds of people that if McCarthy were to go to the speakership, that would open up, of course, other races. And then everybody is swirling on that. And that seems to be getting a lot of attention.
It will, and we'll be looking forward to covering it here, of course, and perhaps talking with you about it in the near future as well. Let me turn to, though, the immediate issue that I was very anxious to visit with you about, and that is the developments that are taking place. As I mentioned, you served in uniform, notably in combat in Tikrit, and were directly involved with the folks who brought Saddam Hussein out of the rat hole, as I recall, the subject of your book, We Got Him, a memoir of the hunt and capture of Saddam Hussein. What do you make, Congressman Steve Russell, of what we're seeing the Russians do at the moment in Syria and with the Iranians, of course, with Bashar Assad, but also with the people that you used to work with, the Iraqis?
Well, it should not be surprising that Russia is involved, as you and I have discussed, I believe, even on this radio show. And we certainly, you know, I have been saying, 14 months ago, that Russia will have an interest there because of the naval base at the port of Tartus. They have the air base at Latakia. They have interest there. And now that you see the rebels within striking distance of some of that, well, it's striking to me that our own administration acts surprised that Russia moved troops there to protect it. And I am really saddened at how amateur this administration is when it comes to that region and foreign policy. We missed an incredible opportunity more than a year ago where, okay, we've got our differences, Crimea, Ukraine, disaster, got that, we're anti-Russia on that, get that. But with terror, we still share intelligence with them, Frank. With the war on terror and all of these Islamo-fascists that are out there, you know, there is a large group of nations that cooperate. And ISIS certainly is chief among the worst of these. And so the missed opportunity more than a year ago was, look, we know you have your naval base there at Tartus. We know you're going to protect it. If you start in Damascus and work your way to the Iraqi border, we'll start in Baghdad and work our way to the Syrian border. You know, whether that's through advising, whether that's through whatever it is, we could have squeezed ISIS out much, much earlier, and we could have done something a lot more, you know, long-lasting. And then you worry about the governments and the geopolitical after that. That doesn't mean you have to remain and stay. We also misread Russia's interest there, and I'm not trying to be a Putin apologist. That's the last thing I would be. But you have, like our bases that we have overseas, you have a community that has grown accustomed to Russians. You have intermarried populations and cultures. You have decades of Russian presence in that area. And so for us to just think, well, oh my gosh, the Russians have come into Syria suddenly. Hello, they've been there for four decades.
Steve, let me ask you about one other piece of this equation. You talk about us moving in Iraq. One of the outfits that apparently the Russians are sharing intelligence with at the moment, and from what you say, it may well be ours, is Iran. They've been partnering in propping up their shared ally, Bashar Assad. Do you have concerns about the role that Iran is playing in all of this at the moment?
Of course I do. I mean, Iran, as you know, I have and continue to oppose the president's executive action on this Iran deal. We are still very much in play with stopping it. I was a original co-sponsor on Patrick Meehan's bill that he did yesterday so that no funds could be sent out before settlements on terror victims were paid. A fantastic measure. I also dropped my own bill that would prohibit any sanctions being lifted with the Iran Terror Financier Transparency Act. And, you know, so we are very much still in this fight. But Iran, they are going to continue to fight proxy wars. They're going to continue to destabilize folks in the region. They're not going to change that behavior. We don't need to embrace them. In terms of intelligence, it's kind of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, they have agreed to share intelligence with both Baghdad and Tehran with Russia. I'm kind of heartened by that because we'll have a chance to read it.
Well, that's an interesting thought.
Well, I mean, I'm being facetious there, but we will be able to penetrate that more than likely.
Let me ask you, in connection with the work that you've been doing, and it's highly laudable to counter this Iran deal, you've also recognized the importance of what states, I believe, like yours, Oklahoma, have done to impose prohibitions on investment by their public pension funds in companies doing business with Iran. This is something that's supposed to go away pursuant to the Obama bomb deal. Congressman Steve Russell, do you think that the states will be able to stand up against the pressure that the feds are going to produce?
We have 15 states now that have signed on to the efforts that we're working. Attorney General Scott Pruitt from the state of Oklahoma and Bill Schutte from Michigan, they were the initial two. This effort is being led by Oklahoma. And now we have 15 states. I believe Indiana was the last one to join. The president says this is not a treaty. We agree with him. And because it's not, the Supremacy Clause does not hold true. And consequently, I mean, if you go back to Medellin versus Texas, the Supreme Court affirmed that states have you know, they have the absolute rights in these cases. And so we are very encouraged by it.
Congressman Russell, we have run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about. I appreciate so much your time and your service to our country, particularly that in uniform, but that you're also providing today. I hope you'll come back to us again soon. And in the meantime, good luck with the fights here and elsewhere. God bless you, sir. We'll talk with Dr. Leon Uris next. We'll get into Putin's patriotic mobilization right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we have the privilege of being joined by a friend of many years, but one that I've not talked with in way too long, and that is Dr. Leon Aron. He is a member of the American Enterprise Establishment, that institute's resident scholar and director of Russian Studies, currently serves on the Broadcasting Board of Governors and has been contributing mightily to the public policy debate on all kinds of issues related to Russia, notably as the editor most recently of Putin's Russia, How It Rose, How It Is Maintained, and How It Might End. Leon Aron, welcome. It's very good to have you with us, sir.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm wondering first and foremost, before we get into some of the particulars of what Putin is up to, whether what he's doing, notably in places like Ukraine and most recently in Syria, has as much to do with trying to divert attention from the domestic economic difficulties of his country at the moment, kind of social engineering, to use the old phrase. Is that your sense of it, Leon?
It's definitely part of it. I would go even deeper on this. When Putin came back to power in 2012, I should not say to power, to formal presidency, he was never out of power. It was clear to him that his economic advisors inside and outside the government were correct, that even when the oil prices were high, the Russian growth, which made Putin popular between 2000 and 2008, when the incomes grew about 7% a year, is no more. The corruption, the reprivatization, you know, all those things that are part of the so-called Russian economic system, created a kind of institutional wall. So his choice was either to reform or to saddle another horse. He could no longer ride the economic growth. It's actually similar to China, and I think with the same results. So Putin made the most fateful choice of his career, for us and for Russia as well. And that is, he decided to legitimize himself. And by the way, he is the only part of that regime that's popular. We know that from the public opinion polls. People really detest it. Instead of economic growth, he'll switch to what I call patriotic mobilization.
Dr. Leon Aron joins us from the American Enterprise Institute, where he directs their Russian Studies program. He was talking about the threat being posed by Vladimir Putin's patriotic mobilization. Dr. Aron, continue that thought, if you would. What are its implications for us?
Well, remember, Putin's popularity was at the record low at the end of 2013. Something needed to be done, and what happened was the annexation of Crimea and the war in Ukraine. So he settled this tiger so far, making it trot pretty well. The problem with, you know, tiger rides, as you know, is that A, you could be eaten, and B, you need to supply a fresh meat, the bloodier the better, every now and then. So Ukraine, it's a separate issue, but Ukraine is on hold. I don't think Putin abandoned it. I think he still wants to destabilize it. But it's on hold. But you need to do something else. Putin touched the nerve. There's no denying that he touched a raw nerve, which is the hurt of the loss of the superpower status. We and our liberal friends in Russia did not know to what extent the loss of that status, the loss of Russia or the Soviet Union, that is respected because it is feared, and that is that sort of puts America in its place, how much of that could contribute to a leader's popularity. He figured it out, and he's doing well. Syria is just one step. Remember, Putin, what I call the Putin doctrine, is the recovery of geostrategic assets that were lost by the Soviet Union. Syria is just one step in that direction. So it's a kind of, you know, two birds with one stone. He hits his geopolitical grand strategy, and he also contributes very handsomely to his domestic popularity.
Maybe a third piece of that, or maybe it's part of the first, is taking down the country that he holds principally responsible for the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, as you know, Leon Aron, namely the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. If you start delving into Putin's credo, one of the things that obviously is clear, that he considers the end of the Cold War the equivalent of the Versailles Treaty for Germany in World War I. A source of endless humiliation. This is a totally false narrative, but he really believes in it, and apparently he persuaded others. So what you do is, unfortunately, it's the parallel that I hate to make, but unfortunately, it's sort of similar to the steps that Hitler took in order to rise in power and stay in power. That is, we will revenge, or in Putin's favorite expression, Russia is off its knees.
And is in the business of humiliating the nations that it believed it was humiliated by, as much as Hitler did with Chamberlain and the French and others. Let me ask you more specifically, Leon Aron, about this is fascinating, and I think patriotic mobilization is exactly the right way to characterize what he's about. When you look at what he's doing in Syria at the moment, the fresh meat, if you will, for the tiger, do you buy the theory, because he does have, as we'll visit about momentarily, a domestic problem with radical Islam or jihadism, but that he can build a buffer against it by working with jihadists as long as they're of the Shiite stripe rather than the Sunni stripe. Is that what's going on here, do you think, in part at least?
You put your finger on this. In fact, I'm working on something that for a couple of years now, taking break from Putin watching, and that is a very dangerous phenomenon, not just to Russia but to the world, and that is the spread of the radical fundamentalist militant Islam outside of the North Caucasus. It's no longer the Chechens that are the problem. I think that it's spreading into the Russian heartlands, and it's touching the Tatars, who are the largest minority, Muslim ethnic minority, and the Bashkirs. Now, what Putin is concerned about, we have statistics, according to the Russian foreign ministry, about 2,400 Russian speakers are in Syria, mainly from Central Asia. And what I think you are talking about, and what definitely is a concern, and that's, by the way, official and not just by the Russian analysts, Putin is deadly afraid of the fall of Afghanistan, which, because of the current policies of the U.S. administration, is bound to happen. And then the fall of the soft underbelly, to quote Churchill, of Central Asia. And remember, there are 2 million Tajiks in Russia, guest workers, 2 million Uzbeks, and about 1 million of Kyrgyz. There is a constant exchange of people. All of them, by the way, get radicalized in Moscow, not in their countries. And yes, Putin is deadly afraid that the ISIS, which redoubled its recruitment, both in Russia and particularly in Central Asia, is going to end up on Russia's borders. So whether he wants to ally himself with Shiites versus Sunni, possible, because of course, the Central Asians and the Tatars and the Chechens are all Sunni Muslims. But I think it's broader than that. I think he is desperately trying to prevent the collapse of Central Asia, which is the only thing, the only territory that separates him from the eye of the storm.
Well, it will be fascinating to watch how this plays out, and I know that you're on it. Your eye is both on the jihadist piece of it, Leon Aaron, as well as on the Putin watching, and your expertise in both of these areas is deeply appreciated. I'd love to have you come back and do a really serious drill down on the various elements of this, because we've only touched the surface. But thank you for the work you're doing at the American Enterprise Institute and taking some time to explain so many of these important themes with us. Let's talk soon. Next up, Alan Dershowitz joins us. We'll talk about Bibi Netanyahu's extraordinary appearance at the United Nations yesterday and the state of U.S.-Israeli relations, Iran, and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Next week, House Republicans will elect a replacement for outgoing Speaker John Boehner. His loyalists want it to be Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. They're now on notice. That would be a disaster. On Tuesday, McCarthy floundered as Fox News' Sean Hannity pressed for evidence the Boehner team had delivered on the promises that gave them a huge Republican majority. In desperation, the congressman claimed the GOP-initiated Select Committee on Benghazi had, quote, driven down Hillary Clinton's poll numbers, unquote. Almost as bad as the sheer stupidity of affirming a false Democrat narrative that the investigation is a partisan ploy was McCarthy's repeated and utterly unconvincing mouthing of talking points, disavowing that was his intent during a return appearance on Fox last night. Kevin McCarthy is clearly unqualified and ill-suited for the job. Republicans must come up with another superior choice. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Alan Dershowitz, one of the country's most eminent thinkers and practitioners of the law, but also one of our country's foremost advocates, both in the public policy sphere as well as in the courts. He is a man who has devoted much time and energy in particular to national security related issues, notably those involving the threat that we face from Iran. He had an opportunity yesterday to be present for and to have a very important conversation on the margins of the speech that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave at the United Nations, and we're anxious to talk with him about it. Alan Dershowitz, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It was Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech was wonderful yesterday. He warned the world that Israel was not bound by an agreement to which it was not a party. And even if the rest of the world is going to sit back and allow Iran to develop a nuclear arsenal, Israel certainly is not going to allow that to happen, because the Iranians have threatened to annihilate Israel, to kill 5 million of its population, even if Israel were to retaliate and kill many, many more in Tehran. The former prime minister of Iran said that trade-off would be worth it, because Israel is a one-bomb state and can be destroyed by one bomb. Israel's just not going to let that happen. And Netanyahu put the world on notice. He also extended an offer of peace to the Palestinians and said, you know, please just come and sit down and negotiate. You can't get peace without negotiation. You're not going to get peace by flying a Palestinian flag at the UN and other symbolism. You're only going to get peace by negotiating. And he also indicated that the relationship between the United States and Israel is mutually beneficial to both sides, that the United States helps Israel a lot, but Israel also helps the United States. It is kind of the representative of the West in the Middle East, the only democracy, the only country that fights terrorism vigorously. So all in all, it was a terrific speech.
I want to come back to some of those other points, but just staying with the speech for a moment, one of the high points, certainly, and it was extraordinary in terms of the drama, really, that it reflected. You've been extraordinarily effective in your rhetoric, but I'm sure you would appreciate the silence for 45 seconds was as dramatic as anything. Talk a little bit about the effect of that, if you would, Alan Dershowitz.
Well, it was a combination of silence and a look from Netanyahu. What he said was, look, when a quarter of a million people have been killed in Syria, the UN does nothing. But when, you know, a few houses are built in the West Bank, the UN will spend the whole year 20 resolutions condemning Israel. And he basically said, stop picking on Israel and start doing something about threats against Israel. And he said, let me dramatically tell you what you've done when a nation state of the United Nations is threatened with annihilation. And then he just looked at the members and he sat there silently. And the silence was so powerful because the silence is exactly what the UN did in Cambodia, in Rwanda. Every time there have been genocides, the United Nations does nothing because it doesn't want to say anything critical of third world countries. It wants to spend all of its time criticizing Israel, the United States, Western democracies. And I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu made that point very effectively by his silence.
One of the things that was not noted by senior members of the U.S. delegation, in fact, was that silence, and for that matter, the rest of the speech. President Obama reportedly summoned, I think it no accident, comrade, out of the General Assembly meeting, the Secretary of State who had been there, and of course our Ambassador Samantha Power. Talk a little bit about the state of the U.S.-Israeli relationship as you see it, Alan. I take very much to heart what you've said and the Prime Minister said about its mutual benefit, but it doesn't seem to be appreciated by President
Obama.
Well,
the United States-Israel relationship is wonderful. The American people support Israel. The Senate supports Israel. The House supports Israel. Most religious leaders support Israel. The relationship between Israel and President Obama is not particularly good because President Obama has been petulant. He's been childish. He has done everything possible to insult Netanyahu, refusing to meet with him, having one of his staff members use inappropriate language in relationship to him. Yesterday is unclear because there was a National Security Council meeting involving Russia, and it occurred at precisely the same time as the Netanyahu speech. I know that the American representatives were prepared to go to the speech, and then they did get summoned out. But I don't want to attribute anything to that particularly. It was probably a function of what was going on in Russia. It's so important for the United States to maintain a good relationship with Israel. And even if a particular president doesn't like the elected leader of Israel, he has to remember that Israel is the only democracy. The people elected Netanyahu. The people support Netanyahu. And the president has to have a better relationship with the official elected representative of the state of Israel because the relationship between the two countries is absolutely essential to the security of both countries.
But let's talk about how this is playing out at the moment, again, in the United Nations. And our guest is Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law Professor Emeritus and author of numerous and extraordinarily important books on a host of subjects, including not least on the Iran deal. And I want to come to that in a moment as well. But Alan, just staying with the United Nations, the president has signaled, I think publicly, as a matter of fact, certainly others in the administration have, that America may not cast a dissenting vote or a veto, effectively, on an effort in the United Nations Security Council that's expected soon that would effectively, if not literally, recognize Palestine as a state outside of the Camp David and all the rest of the peace processes. What is up with that, and what might the implications be should that go down?
Well, that would be a disaster. That would really end any possibility of a two-state solution based on a negotiated resolution. You can't have the UN impose statehood on Palestine without Palestine being willing to make the kind of compromises. And even the threat that the United States might not veto this has increased the Palestinian resolve not to sit down and negotiate. The reason that the Palestinians are not sitting down and negotiating is that they believe they can get what they want without giving up anything. And that's the message the United States and the United Nations has sent when they say, well, maybe we'll pass a resolution recognizing Palestine without the need for the Palestinians to sit down and negotiate. So it's counterproductive to peace.
And coming back to the deal, you've fought it tooth and tong. I'm hoping that fight is not yet over, especially with what we're seeing playing out now in terms of the emboldened behavior on the part of the Iranians with help from the Russians in Syria and so on. But give us a flavor in light of what you mentioned, the Senate and the House supporting Israel. But in the event, 42 Democratic senators voted against Israel, did they not, when they refused to have a vote in the Senate opposing that deal?
Well, first of all, it was disgraceful that the filibuster, the discredited tactic that had been used to keep the South segregated for so many years, was invoked to stop Democratic debate, to stop a full vote. And yes, the president did manage to get one-third plus one of one branch of Congress to support the deal. But we have to remember that a majority of the American public was against it, a majority of the Senate, a majority of the House were against it. Those that voted for it did not see themselves as being anti-Israel. They thought, many of them, that the deal was not particularly good, but that the alternative might be worse. That was the bill of goods, I think, that was sold by the administration to several members of the Senate and Congress. That's why in my book, The Case Against the Iran Deal, I make a proposal that Congress and the Senate ought now to pass a law saying, we accept the first part of the deal in the preface, where Iran says that it will never under any circumstances seek to develop or acquire nuclear weapons. That becomes American policy, and we authorize the president, this president and future presidents, to take whatever action is necessary, including military action, to make sure that Iran never under any circumstances develops nuclear weapons. That would be a way of at least salvaging the good part of the deal without giving the Iranians everything they want in exchange for the United States getting very little except some delay in exchange.
An incredibly important insight and initiative. We look forward to working with you to see what can be done on that score and perhaps others, maybe litigation, who knows. Alan Dershowitz, your leadership is tremendously important and appreciated. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again if you would soon. Peter Pry joins us next to talk about EMP and why that could be an Iranian threat going forward. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by one of the most, well, thoughtful and, I believe, effective advocates I've come across in my time in Washington. His passion has been our national security. He has advanced it both in a distinguished career in the Central Intelligence Agency, where he was one of their experts on nuclear issues and proliferation and the threats they pose to our country. He has also served in a number of capacities on Capitol Hill, including as a professional staff member of the House Armed Services Committee and as a staff member of the EMP Commission, which I'm very pleased to say has just been given a new lease on life. Today, he is the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, an advisory committee for the Congress. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Peter, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you for that generous introduction.
Well, it's only the truth. Let me talk about one of your newest products, a piece that you co-authored with four other eminent figures in the national security domain, including, of course, our friends Jim Woolsey, Hank Cooper, Bill Graham, and Fritz Ehrmarth. These are men who, together with you, have weighed in on a question that is of enormous moment, namely, does Iran already have the bomb? Talk about why you think that the answer may be yes.
Well, let me just say that my distinguished co-authors, just in case they're not familiar to the audience, Woolsey was the former director of the CIA under Bill Clinton. Dr. Graham was Ronald Reagan's science advisor and chairman of the EMP Commission. Ambassador Cooper, director of the Strategic Defense Initiative, and Fritz Ehrmarth was the chairman of the National Intelligence Council under Reagan and the National Security Advisor to Reagan. So these are some of the great minds that won the Cold War. And we believe, looking at the facts about the Iranian nuclear weapons program, one of the most obvious ones is that Iran, even before the mullahs, for 65 years under the Shah, they basically had a low-scale nuclear program. And then for the last 25 to 30 years under the mullahs, after the Iranian Revolution, they've been crashing out of the bomb for 25 to 30 years. Yet we know that in our own Manhattan Project, it took the United States only 3 years to build the bomb. And if you look at a survey of how long it's taken all of the states that have gone nuclear, there's 10 nations that have developed nuclear weapons. All of them have done it within 3 to 12 years. And yet Iran has been working on the bomb for more than twice that long. So it seems implausible to us that they don't have the bomb yet. Moreover, they've had help. We know they're getting help from the Russians and the Chinese, and they're using modern technology. There's all kinds of unclassified data available on nuclear weapons design. And the United States had none of that during the Manhattan Project in World War II when we built the bomb in 3 years. Next, the 2011 International Atomic Energy Agency report, you know, if people actually bother to read it, it's full of excellent data. Now, we're no great respecters of the IAEA as a watchdog. And in fact, in some respects, their report deserves criticism because it's full of evidence. It's full of smoking gun evidence that Iran not only has a nuclear weapons program, but they actually already have the bomb already. And yet the IEA was either not smart enough or not courageous enough to actually say so openly. I do think, though, that they laid that evidence out so that others, at least, could come to the correct conclusions. And so, to just name a few examples in the report, you know, we know from the IAEA report that Iran actually took and metallized uranium and shaped the uranium into hemispheres, so that you could, which is what you would do if you were designing an implosion device, which is one of the more sophisticated kinds of nuclear weapons, and that they actually tested it, not a full yield nuclear test, you know, that would produce a big explosion, but that they tested it, an implosion device, using the chemical lenses to see if they could compress this uranium core. And I'm sure it wasn't highly enriched uranium. It was lower enriched uranium, so you wouldn't get a nuclear explosion. But it's called a hydrodynamic nuclear test in an explosion chamber, which was located at Parchin, by the way, which is the place that the Iranians are being allowed to inspect themselves.
Peter, let me turn quickly, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about specifically your concerns that what Iran might do with this nuclear capability is to use it in a strategic attack against the United States of almost unimaginable consequence. Remind us why we should be concerned about the electromagnetic pulse threat.
Because with a single nuclear weapon, they could end us as a civilization. They could take a missile, like their Shahab 3 medium-range missile, which would be ideal for this purpose, and put it on a freighter and launch a single warhead at high altitude over the center of the United States. And it would cause an EMP, which is like a super energetic radio wave, that would destroy electronics across the whole continental United States and create a blackout that would last months or even years. And the Congressional EMP Commission, which I served, you know, estimated that if we had a blackout that lasted just 1 year, they could actually make real their threat to bring death to America, because it would kill 9 of 10 Americans by starvation, disease, and societal collapse. And one of the things in the 2011 IAEA report is that it's obvious that the Iranians were trying to, they worked on coming up with 14 workable nuclear weapon designs so they could fit it into the high explosive reentry vehicle of the Shahab 3. You know, why would they go through all that trouble? It's so much more difficult to design a nuclear weapon than it is to change the shape of a reentry vehicle. Obviously, they were trying to disguise a nuclear warhead so it would look like a high explosive warhead in the Shahab 3. And this is extremely, extreme. I think this sends another big signal. And the implication of that is this. Almost every other nation that has gotten nuclear weapons has done it for purposes of deterrence, for purposes of prestige, and have made it a matter of public record that they've got the bomb, except for Iran. Even Israel follows a policy of deliberate ambiguity where they play a kind of fan dance, so the people basically know they've got it. Only the Iranians are trying to keep it a deep, dark secret. Why is that? You only do that if you plan to use them.
Peter, we're almost out of time. Quickly, we have just had the very happy news that we've had the reauthorization of the commission on which you served so valiantly for so long, the EMP Commission, by the new National Defense Authorization Act. Give us a flavor of why it is imperative that that commission be back in business, and will we have a chance to have you serving on it once again?
Well, the commission was the main engine. When the commission was around, we made the most progress since the end of the Cold War on protecting our country from EMP. You know, the commission was the engine driving that forward, and they made a lot of progress on the Department of Defense. And just as they were turning their attention to the civilian critical infrastructures, the commission went out of business. Its mandate to operate ran out. And ever since then, heroic people like you, have been joining forces with me and other basically patriotic individuals and non-government organizations that have very little resources and no power to basically exercise moral suasion at the federal level and with the states to try to educate people about the EMP threat and to make progress. And amazingly, we have been able to make progress, but it's a very lopsided battle that we've been waging, as you know better than anybody, Frank, a David and Goliath affair. And for the EMP Commission to come back, because we're fighting a huge electric power industry called the NERC that doesn't want to do anything, and they have vast resources at their disposal while we have almost nothing on our side.
Well, what we have is the truth. And Peter Pry, you have been an extraordinarily effective articulator of that truth. And I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your leadership in this area. And we look forward to working with you and the new commission in the days ahead to protect our country. The vulnerability of our electric grid being, I think, the absolute utmost priority. My friend, the author of Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, come back to us again very soon. Next up, Mark Krikorian joins us. We'll talk about the hearing Jeff Sessions had in the Senate yesterday. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by one of the country's most eminent activists and thinkers about the immigration concerns all of us, I think, have or should at the very least. He is Mark Krikorian, the executive director and driving force behind a truly indispensable organization in Washington. It's called the Center for Immigration Studies. We wanted to catch up with Mark in particular in connection with a very important hearing that took place yesterday by Senator Jeff Sessions, a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee, focused on what the administration is doing and has in mind doing in connection with this so-called refugee crisis in Syria and elsewhere, much in the news as a result of the very vivid images now coming from the efforts of the Europeans to deal with the invasion, hijra, if you will, of many of these folks from the Middle East and North Africa. Mark Krikorian, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, I know you didn't have a chance to watch the hearing yesterday, but I know you know some of the high points of it. Let's talk a little bit about why this is such an extraordinary event. It does seem as though there has been an incredible dearth of oversight hearings. So we commend Senator Sessions for having convened one. But what did you think was the most important takeaway from it?
Well, like you said, the very fact that they're actually examining the refugee resettlement program is something that's remarkable, because it's this, you know, it imports a significant number this year, this past year, 70,000 refugees who turn into permanent immigrants. It's really just a regular part of the immigration program. And it just goes on autopilot. Nobody pays any attention to it. In this particular hearing, I think probably the most interesting thing was that 90% of the people that they look into, that they do background checks on, they approve for settlement in the United States. And, you know, I wouldn't even want to suggest that the folks in the field at Homeland Security or State Department or elsewhere aren't doing their jobs. You know, these people, they're patriotic Americans. They're trying to make sure they're doing their best and keep out terrorists and the rest. But they pretty much acknowledge that there's no way really they can do that properly. I mean, who are they going to call up? The Damascus Police Department? They're going to check with the Syrian Social Security Administration? I mean, they have no idea who these people are. They're doing their best, but it is a task that's impossible to do properly.
This is against the backdrop of a broken immigration system more broadly. It's not just the refugee resettlement piece, bad as that is. Senator Sessions wanted to note that this week is the 50th anniversary of the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Acts enactment. Mark, you have been wrestling with the repercussions of this act for many, many years. Talk a little bit about what it set in train and how it's worked out.
You're right. It is the 50th anniversary of this is LBJ's immigration changes, which Ted Kennedy helped usher through Congress. It was part, really, of the. It was another one of the many consequences of the Democrat landslide in '64, with Medicare. What happened after that? All kinds of things. And what it did, even though the immigration law has been tinkered with some since then, it did set the paradigm for today's immigration system. And every assurance that people made at the time was about how this wasn't going to be a big deal has been proven false. Let me just read you one sentence. It's great. From Ted Kennedy speaking at a hearing on this. He said, "This bill will not flood our cities with immigrants. It will not upset the ethnic mix of our society. It will not relax the standards of admission. It will not cause American workers to lose their jobs." Every assertion made about this bill was false. And it seems to me the key takeaway and the thing we need to always keep in mind is that anything people are telling us about new comprehensive immigration bills is likely to turn out to be false as well.
And Mark, you know, Kennedy in particular seemed to be so keen on actually assuring the opposite would be the effect, that the diversity, that, you know, the disproportionate number of folks from similar kinds of societies, notably Europeans, would be eliminated in favor of bringing them in from God knows where, and with heavens knows what effect.
See, the point of the bill was to get rid of the cockamamie system we had from the 20s, where each different countries had different numbers, and the point was we didn't want a lot of, you know, Italians and Jews coming in, and so they had small numbers. It was a sort of a dumb way of limiting immigration. So the point was to clean that up explicitly as part of the civil rights movement. The problem is that what they did was essentially start this ticking time bomb to massively increase numbers rather than just clean up the system and keep the numbers the way they were. That was the promise. You know, how many times do we have to be lied to about immigration policy before people wake up?
Well, and as you say, I mean, you're hearing similar kinds of assurances in connection with the comprehensive immigration reform. Going back to Europe for just a moment, because I know you're following as a kind of object lesson of what happens when this process runs amok. What's the latest in terms of how these refugees that are now being taken in immense numbers, notably by Germany, but because of Germany, by everybody else, it seems, how that's working out, Mark Krikorian?
Well, what's happened is that there's so many people moving into Germany. There's something, I think it's 500,000 so far just this year, and this year isn't over. In fact, it's accelerating. What seems to be happening from a variety of German local news reports is that Germans are actually being evicted from their apartments and homes by local, you know, local mayors and what have you, in order to create room for refugees. Some local governments are actually seizing private property, you know, homes, the vacant homes, commercial space. There was a school that was seized. Everybody had 24 hours to get out and find a new place to have the school in order to house refugees. I mean, it's just, it's topsy-turvy. I mean, they're expelling people from their homes in order to fill them with refugees. It's unbelievable.
It bears repeating, refugees who may have as their purpose the revolutionary sort of jihadist impulses that they bring with them from these Sharia-adherent countries, notably Syria. Our guest is Mark Krikorian, the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Among his books is How Obama is Transforming America Through Immigration. And Mark, just in closing on that point, we're told by the administration and some of its friends that we need to be regarding these individuals, whether they're coming in illegally or whether they're coming in legally, as not immigrants, not migrants, but new Americans. Give us a flavor of what that suggests and portends.
I mean, there really is a sense across much of the left that, you know, immigrants are a way to change American society to make it more the way they like it. And, you know, that's what I find most perverse about it, is that it's used as a kind of social engineering, a political engineering, by those promoting a larger state and a very different form of polity in the United States. And you know, this is Bertolt Brecht had this poem he wrote in a different context, but at one point he ends it by saying, "Wouldn't it be easier to just dissolve the people and elect a new one?" Referring to the parliament, but flipping it around, instead of dissolving the government, dissolve the people and elect a new one. And immigration is the tool that you see elites, both in the United States and in Europe, using for precisely that kind of purpose.
Our colleague Jim Simpson has put out a new book for us called The Red-Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Erasing of America. I commend it to all of you. Available at securefreedom.org. Mark Krikorian, your availability to us is deeply appreciated. Thanks for, again, the great work you do at the Center for Immigration Studies. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. And the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.